You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
To the midside, where the one week we don't have a queer co-host is the week the news is the gayest. I'm your host, Justin Wisniewski, and if you want to report me for everything I just said, then you really need to go back and listen to past episodes. And if you don't want to report me for everything I just said, then you really need to go back and listen to past episodes with a friend. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I saw what you did there. Very clever turn of phrase. You and William Shakespeare, really, right up there.
Wow, that's, wow. I mean, mm-hmm. I try. I'm trying to get better with those openings. I'm trying to make the plug more cohesive with the quip at the beginning, which is really, it's more difficult than you think.
Yeah, no, the plug quip coefficient is just, that's the tough one to really game out.
I mean, I could just go the direction of the Adam and Drew show and just do gibberish at the beginning.
True. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on.
How are you feeling, Daniel? This is our last regular episode of season 6. Next episode is the awards show.
Well, I feel like crap. But that has nothing to do with the show.
That's right. You were listed as questionable with an illness this week on the interview. What do you have?
The shortest version of the story is that my son woke up in the middle of the week projectile vomiting. So for anyone who doesn't have children, that's something to look forward to. It's like The Exorcist. Walls, crib, floor. That's fun.
I have a question, though. Mm-hmm. How far can a baby projectile vomit? Oh. I mean, they don't have much strength.
He hit some parts of the ceiling, so.
I kind of want to see this. Like, this seems like a feat.
It is a sight to behold. Anyway, he was in good spirits. But we took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, it's probably because of his teething. It's probably he's in pain from teething, and he's vomiting from teething. I don't know anything, Justin, when it comes to the medical world, so I said, okay, we don't need any drugs, like the parents shouldn't be taking any, you know, precautionary drugs or doing anything precautionary. The guy said, no, just go about your business. And then lo and behold, 2 days later, what should his father be doing? But something very similar, as it was not
teething?
Due to teeth. That's right. I caught the teething. I'm getting a second row like a shark. No, in fact, I caught the other thing. It was, in fact, not related to teething, but is probably the stomach flu, in fact. So, and since then, one of his aunts has come to the house, and she has also caught the teething, as we'll continue to call it. So, thank you, doctors.
You should have gotten the teething shot from the government.
I should have. That would have really helped. I did get the flu shot. Apparently, that does not work against the stomach flu. So, poorly named flu shot. It should be called the only a few flu shot. But otherwise, I'm feeling better now, except that I'm still on a fairly toast banana based diet. So, life. And yeah. Despite the news being gay, I will not be identifying as a woman to forego my white male gay privilege or whatever it is that William does.
Okay, stop trying to take William's thing.
Okay.
And what I was just going to say before you randomly change the subject, I don't know why. It is true. I have heard of the idea that if you're in so much pain, you vomit. Mm-hmm. But I really feel like your doctor just copped out. I feel like he didn't know what it was. So he was like, he's just teething. He's a baby. Baby's teeth. That's my answer. I feel like he gave up is what I think happened.
Yeah. And I suspect that there, even if he had said this is a highly contagious stomach flu, there's probably nothing we could have done about it. It's not like we're going to put our baby in quarantine and just let him cry it out for a few days. So I suspect we would get it anyway, but I just have this thing about doctors lately being woefully inaccurate with just about everything they do. So any Midsiders out there who might be in medical school, if you could please be not a horrible doctor, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Also, if you could stop studying and diagnose Daniel's baby rather than... I mean, I feel like I could have done a better job. I could have been like, probably not teething. I'm going to guess it's not the teething.
I'm going to guess the projectile vomiting and diarrhea is not from teething.
Also, reason number 32, Justin can't be a parent. I would just put my kid in quarantine. If my kid is reminding me of The Exorcist, quarantine.
That's right. Don't touch it. Don't look at it. Don't think about it. We don't have a baby for the next 2 days.
Pretty much. And you know what? That's how I feel about the news a lot of the time, especially this week. So let's get into it and talk about who we should be putting in quarantine in the news with David T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
For all you Midsiders out there who love the news with me, you can help support this show by being a Patreon subscriber, although we're going to talk about some of the weirdness of Patreon in the news. Very meta. But you can go to patreon.com/themidside and choose to give a small amount, or big amount, if you're feeling it, of money per episode, per piece of content that we create. So it's not just a monthly flat fee. It's not if we go to Maui or something, even though I'm never going to Maui again, you know, and we don't release any content, then you're not going to pay. So Patreon helps us keep the lights on, at least for now. We'll see you in the news.
And sometimes, if I'm not happy with the quality of an episode, I won't even charge you guys for it. Like, I believe the episode I did by myself, that was gratis. People actually wrote me, and they were like, we would have paid for this. And I was like, wait, people like me and would have paid for me to just talk by myself? It was so foreign to me, Daniel. The idea that people would just pay to listen to me talk...
Yeah,
I thought they would be angry. That's literally why I didn't charge. I was like, I'm not going to charge for this episode of me ranting because no one's going to pay for this.
Now, see, if I did a solo episode, I'd charge double. So that's where my ego is.
All right, then.
All right. The news. Pardon me. I have the vomit voice, as they say.
The teething voice.
The teething voice, as they say, in that my throat hurts. Okay. Anti-gay comments made 16 years ago have cost a SDSU professor an appearance before a House committee. Now, that's a weirdly specific thing, but the article is fascinating. Fascinating. Okay.
Before we get started, this professor kind of looks like Zack Snyder. Did you notice that?
A little bit. He looks a little bit Zack Snyder-y. If Zack Snyder was a bigger nerd and more into politics, maybe. Yeah.
If you cross Brett Kavanaugh with Zack Snyder, I think you get this guy.
Oh, God. Social justice nightmare. The stuff that their nightmares are made of, in fact. A San Diego State University economist made anti-gay remarks, quote unquote, 16 years ago, and they've sparked a political flap that led to the postponement of a congressional hearing on the minimum wage. Joseph Sabia had been scheduled to appear on Wednesday before the House Committee on Workforce and Education on the effects of raising the minimum wage to $15, but the session was postponed when the committee learned he had made anti-gay and anti-feminist comments on a blog he wrote when he was a student at Cornell. The remarks had been taken down, in fact, but they remained in an internet archive and were shared with committee members, drawing their ire. And if anyone else read that the way I did, it was in passive voice. And thus we don't know who shared these things with the committee members. So that's
the aggressive voice.
The passive aggressive voice. That's right. Sabia apologized for his comments, and SDSU issued a statement saying that the old posts do not represent the university's values. The week's controversy largely stems from remarks he made in 2002.
Yes. I have to interrupt you because of the voice you just did. The people who lead San Diego State University are the Gungan King from Phantom Menace.
These are no like these comments he made.
That's the voice you just did.
It kind of is. I meant it to be a sort of jowly, sort of uppity, ignorant academic. That was the voice that was intended.
Which also, I believe, describes the portrayal of the Gungans by George Lucas.
Exactly, except that I couldn't use the word uppity because then it would be racist in that context. But
right, I was insinuating that George Lucas is racist.
He is. Okay. In a column that mocked liberals' supposed love of taxation, Sabia said the right wing should respond by taxing and regulating homosexual acts. And here we get into it. Quote, this is Sabia, quote, in 2002, quote, "But first we have to mount the assault on big gay. No, I'm not talking about Rosie O'Donnell. We can tax gay nightclubs, websites, personal ads, sexual paraphernalia, and so forth. Talk about a sin tax. 3 exclamation points. We can cripple gay-related industries and get them right where we want them. All gay clubs will have to feature huge flashing warning signs like, caution, entering this nightclub may increase the chance of contracting STDs and dying." Well, there you go. In a subsequent column, he said that women's rights movement had effectively encouraged young women to behave like whores. His words. So he goes on, this is Sabia, in modern day, in a statement on Tuesday saying, quote, "I regret the hurtful and disrespectful language I used as a satirical college opinion writer 20 years ago. And here, folks, this next sentence is what we call the payoff of the article. Quote, this is still Sabia. Quote, "I am a gay man in a long-term committed relationship, and these charges of homophobia deeply hurt both me and my family." Oh my God, he's gay. Okay, Justin, it used to be that when you were a member of the in-group, I'm old enough to remember last week when you were a member of the in-group and you could then make fun of and criticize and say anything you wanted about the in-group that you were a part of. Is that no longer the case?
Oh, it's definitely no longer the case. I mean, that's something William has been tracking on this show for a long time, right? We saw the stuff about black males are the white males of the black community. Remember that article?
Yes.
And that actually leads into our next article. So let's put that aside for a moment, okay? Because that's our second article, right? Conservative gays need to shut the fuck up. That's the article title. Just want to be clear. I'm not saying that. So that leads into our next article. That's a great point. But the fact that that is buried deeply within the article, the fact that he is gay, just shows the complete agenda of all of this. The farce could not be more transparent than it is right now. You're reading this whole thing, and even when you read the article, right, the comments about the gay stuff is very satirical, right? It's Jonathan Swift. It's like
it is classic college satire. I wrote stuff, I mean, not that kind of stuff, but I wrote incredibly similar sort of juvenile level college satire when I was an undergrad. Totally.
Right. And it's like people nowadays would think Jonathan Swift actually wanted to eat babies, that he was actually advocating for that.
Absolutely.
And that's interesting. You talk about your experience writing it
or something. Yeah.
This guy was in Cornell in 2002. That's in Ithaca. This is in the opposite hill of me. And I think I was literally in college the same time as this guy, saying the same thing, writing the same kind of things. Again, not as extreme as you and him probably wrote, probably less extreme. But my question is just, where was this guy? Why did I never meet this guy? This seems like somebody I should have been friends with, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Like when you see this and he's at Ithaca at the same time as me? And people have to understand the context is, he was satirizing this whole social justice culture before it was mainstream. He was dealing with this back then, and that's why he was writing it. And that's why this is so fascinating to me, because we're now to the point where we're postponing or limiting House committee meetings on something like the minimum wage because in college, a gay guy wrote a satirical comment about being gay.
Indeed. And that he later deleted. Like, he later took it down. I mean, you could write something and then regret it or outgrow it or decide that you don't, it's inappropriate and take it down. And now not only are you judged based on what you said, but based on things that you have consciously deleted and someone then dug up and gave to the committee. As Adam Carolla would say, who is this guy who dug this crap up and gave it to the committee? I want to know who that guy is so we can ostracize and shun that guy. Because, jeezy Pete's, man, pay some attention to your own life and leave some other people alone. My goodness.
Well, that's a grammar question about social media, Daniel. And it's one I've been having ongoing with Midsider Katrina is because of social media, the social ostracizing of people face to face doesn't happen anymore. And what I mean by that is there are people you know not to listen to because you just get a weird vibe from them or you can tell there's something off with them. Well, on the internet, you can't tell that. And they band together and they use these tools to legitimize themselves by digging things up or by finding other like-minded crazy people. So 20,000 people on the internet seems like a big deal. But if that was the one person in your town without the internet, that would just be the town crazy. Oh, that's just the really weird dude who likes to dig up old comments by people. We don't pay attention to him. He's weird. But now
that's old man Jenkins. No one listens to old man Jenkins.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you will indulge me in a quick story about satire, I wrote a satire piece my freshman year of college. It actually won me a writing award, you know, back when people could actually read and write and appreciate satire. This was back when I was a full-fledged conservative, although not a religious one, and I was pro-life, or more accurately, anti-abortion, and now I'm pro-choice. But the satire piece was based on the Swiftian model, and I think I called it my strategic proposal or something like that. But the point is that I basically made the argument that we should not restrict but expand abortion rights. For all the exact reasons that abortion advocates use, the exact reasons they use, but we should extend abortion rights to the age of 25. Meaning that if you want to abort your child up to the age of 25, you should be able to do so. For all the exact same reasons that abortion advocates use today, including harm to the mother's life. And I called this person a fetus, but a free-loathing entity inconveniently taking up space was the acronym. And so I can't even imagine now that, well, I've said it now on a podcast, but I can't even imagine if someone dug up that paper, what they would think of that today, especially in the context of all the things I believe today, the things that the opinions in my life that have changed, the context that have changed, the premises that have changed, the philosophy that has massively changed. What people would think of that satire that I wrote my freshman year of college. I can't even imagine the type of judgment that I would get from that with no context whatsoever, just as this professor is getting with no context whatsoever for something he wrote and then later deleted. So I'm weary of casting aspersions on people, especially for things they wrote when their brains were still forming.
You know, now that you tell that story, I think I wrote a similar Swiftian piece, not about abortion, but I remember I took a humor writing class and we had to do a piece of satire based on a modest proposal. And I did something about reparations. And I believe what I did was, and this is funny because it sounds super alt-right, so maybe I did write something as bad as this guy. I believe it was we should set them up with their own country, like found an island state for them and put them all there so that they can have everything they need and we'll have given everything back to them. I believe that's what it was.
Oh, look at you. Echoing some Republicans from the Civil War era. Excellent. Mine was called My Humble Proposal. Thank you for saying modest proposal. I wasn't that clever. It was just My Humble Proposal. But anyway, so this, of course, leads us directly to the story that you foreshadowed earlier, which I usually save like the concourse and Gizmodo and Jalopnik and Jezebel for Woker Joke because I sometimes can't tell if these people are being satirical or honest. But in this case, I think they're being pretty honest. And the title of this article, again, is Conservative Gays Need to Shut the Duck Up, except clearly not duck.
Did you just get auto-corrected?
I have to auto-correct myself live. So, and the article begins like this. Quote, on Tuesday, conservative rag, the Federalist, which I have to mention now for no particular reason, has no association whatsoever with another group by a similar name, the Federalist Society. End of unnecessary disclaimer. A website perhaps best known for its endorsement of statutory rape and its former use of a black crime tag published an opinion blog by a gay guy named Chad Felix Green titled, "The Stigma Against My Conservative Politics is Worse Than the Stigma of Being Gay." That's good news, right? I mean, in a utopian society, no one would much care who people prefer to duck or fall in love with, but everyone would care deeply about the laws and policies that actually impact the world. So our hypothetical utopian folks wouldn't bat an eye at two men sharing a kiss, but would likely get pretty pissed if someone came advocating the use of tear gas against people in need, or death for sick people who don't have the money to pay for treatment, or killing machines for everybody. All of which are mainstream conservative points of view. So it's sentences like that, Justin, that let me know that I'm reading someone who's very intellectually honest, and that I should be getting something really deeply insightful out of this article.
Wait, okay. When did conservatives tear gas people in need?
This is a border thing recently. Tear gas used against people who were storming the border wall, I think.
Oh, okay. So the people trying to come into our house without our permission.
That's a conservative argument that I won't get into. It's both sides are wrong here, per usual.
I wasn't saying that the conservative side was right, per se.
I was just saying
that that's a huge straw man.
But death for sick people who don't have money to pay treatment and killing machines for everybody weren't bigger straw men here for you? Anyway, they're all enormous straw men. Point being, this guy's a douche.
Okay. Honestly, I forgot the killing machine ones. I was trying to remember that.
Killing machines.
That's
for everybody.
That's not a straw man. I want everyone to have killing
for
machines.
For everybody. Killing machines. Okay.
Let's just cut to the chase. Let's give everyone killing machines, and we'll just get this civil war going quicker.
That's right. So he continues, quote, "What I'm saying is conservative politics should have more of a stigma than being queer, but apparently my saying so hurts Green's feelings." Then he quotes from the article. Did you want me to read any of the quotes from the article in particular, Justin? Because there are a lot of them. I don't know if there's one in particular you wanted to draw out or not.
No, use your best judgment. I trust
you. Okay. So I don't want to. So, you know, he goes on to the author of the original article goes on to say something to the effect of, like, just because he didn't choose to be gay and he also didn't choose to be conservative. He became a conservative because there was basically no choice. He came to value truth and reason, and so he had to become a conservative.
Wait, he had to become a conservative?
Yes.
Because he values truth and... Did I miss something?
That's right. Does not follow. So this is the end, which I like. "Normally, the Federalists farting out some jaw-droppingly stupid false equivalence is just another weekday, but conservative gays using their sexuality as a means to defend their abhorrent views have become more and more common as queers win more widespread acceptance. Opportunities that would have been previously unavailable for out gays in fields like business or politics are opening up like never before, giving LGBT people newfound power to create change within the systems that previously oppressed them. But wealthy and mostly white gay men have all too often been afforded the choice not to shed the oppressed label, but to become oppressors themselves. Their sexuality then becomes a tool used to help uphold the anti-feminist, white supremacist, wealth-favoring status quo, and they need to ducking stop." Justin, if we were playing social justice bingo, I would have heard you jump up right there at the end, because that was basically all of them, right?
Yeah,
anti-feminist, white supremacist, wealth-favoring status quo, oppressed, oppressor, white gay men, etc., etc., etc. Bingo!
Yahtzee! Is Yahtzee
different
oppressive?
Game.
I don't know.
Different game.
Yeah, I don't know if Yahtzee's oppressive. But not only what makes this article so amazing is not only is it social justice bingo, but it shows what's wrong with the right wing too. It's everything that's wrong in one article. It's hard to believe it even exists. The idea that you don't have a choice. Oh, I had to be conservative. I had to be right wing. What? What? When did we get away from this idea of, and this goes to the whole collectivism thing here, right? I'm channeling William a little bit because this is what he would probably talk about. This goes back to the whole collectivism thing. you're either in one group or the other, and you have no choice about it. There's no free will to be an individual anymore, and this is a perfect example of it. And I'm sure that's why William shared this article in Discord and why he continually brings up these issues, because, as I said, he's the one who brought up the one about how, like, black men are now the white men of black people. Mm-hmm. And he continually talks about how, you know, gay men now have privilege because, you know, white gay men have privilege. And that was even in this article, right? It's the rich white gays that are the problem.
That's
Fuck
right.
The rich white gays. All the other gays are fine, but those rich white gays. The problem is, because of collectivism, when you have these identities that are in supposedly contradictory groups, you then become this sort of persona non grata even more than just when you're part of a group, and that takes away your individualism. Not only is your individualism taken away, but you are now evil for the sake of you haven't picked a side.
Yes, totally. I think, and not think, I know for a fact that this is the inevitability of all identity politics. In-grouping and micro-identity will lead to in-group oppressor-oppressed dynamics. It has to, because that is the nature of identity politics itself. Identity politics can only thrive when there is someone at the top and someone who is being oppressed. And the moment someone gets to the top this is sort of a la Victor Vitanza, if anyone wants to look up that horrible name and his horrible ideas, then no matter, even if that person was once your ally, they must be destroyed. The moment someone gains any amount of success, quote-unquote privilege, advantage in any way, they must be destroyed, and that horrible merry-go-round of Marxist ideas must continue ad infinitum for identity politics to work at all.
Look, so, Daniel, to yes. use a pop culture metaphor, as I always do, this has been vetted out and shown in the strategy of Survivor since the beginning. It's the same thing where you just said, if anyone within your group, within your alliance, has any sort of power that threatens you because you're afraid they could use that power against you, you believe you have to preemptively strike and get them out, even though they're on your side. This is exactly what you're talking about. But that has been shown in the history of Survivor, that if you do that and you have no loyalty and you don't treat people as individuals in that way, what you're doing is you're making the game more chaotic and making it easier for people to turn on you eventually. Because what you're just saying is this is just randomness, and everything can change every vote. So there aren't alliances going forward. Even though you believe you're in groups, even though these people believe they're in groups, these collective groups they're in are only for the immediate problem, for the immediate advantage in whatever situation they're in. Then when the next situation comes along, they'll cut your throat in an instant. And yeah, I'm mixing the metaphor here to use Survivor in real life and blur the line, because that's the point. That's exactly what they're doing. Oh, this guy is great when he was gay because he was on their side. Oh, but he's an economist? Oh, well, because he's an economist and he's going to go against the minimum wage, now we can use the fact that he's conservative against him, even though his success as a gay man before that helped our, as he called it, the big gay agenda.
That's right. So, your politics, your philosophy, your life should not be based on an identity, whether it be chosen or accidental in most cases, i.e. the product of genetics or something else. It should be based on ideas that you choose, ideas that you understand because you go out into the world and you see them enacted in reality, ideas that you gain not just because someone told you about them, but because you have investigated them with your own mind and decided based on evidence that they are correct. Ideas are the only way to fight identity politics. Individualism.
So I have a challenge for you then, Daniel.
Okay. I like challenges.
Let's do a brief life on the midside here. In what way do your ideas contradict the way you would have been if you just developed based upon what you had to do in the way this guy says he did?
Well, that's interesting. One is I'm Hispanic. So if I had, you know, if I quote unquote had to live with my identity as a Hispanic man, I would have taken on all these sort of oppressor-oppressed relationships between, for instance, the migrant Mexicans and others coming here, and versus the evil people who want to keep them out, etc., and have no nuance in the discussion of borders, have no nuance whatsoever in the discussion of immigration. Growing up, you know, my mother was staunchly leftist, and I remember her giving me the woman's right to choose talk when I was about 9. So, of course, I would have had to do that because my mother was also a single mother, and she was held down by the system because she had no choice and blah, 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 etc. And then in school, the number one influencing thing when I was younger in school was environmentalism. I don't know if you know this about me, Justin, but from the ages like 6 to, I don't know, 12 or 13, I was a committed, staunch environmentalist. Like, I thought that was the most important thing in the universe. I recycled. I had an environmental club. Like, I would lecture my parents and grandparents for leaving the water running for any given period of time. Like, I was convinced we were all going to die because of environmental damage. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what you're looking for, but those are the three main things that stick out to me that would be radically different if I didn't actually think about ideas per se, but instead just identified with the groups that were most closely associated with me.
That's 100% what I was thinking of, because I think it's important to demonstrate the way it's done differently, because I think that's the value of this show, is to show that there are people out there that are making choices that are different from the groups they grew up around, and they are choosing to be individuals.
Absolutely. I mean, if I had to come to objectivism via a group, meaning some group had to be objectivist and then I had to see that group and want to be a part of that in-group, I would have never come to objectivism. When I discovered Ayn Rand in college, it was because one professor sort of off the cuff said, when I asked him if there are any philosophers in the world who cared to live, that was my question to him after a contemporary philosophy class, said, some people get some, you know, some joy out of reading Ayn Rand or something. And so I went and spent oodles of time in the library looking up Ayn Rand, couldn't find her, of course. Point being, there was no one in my undergraduate to talk to about this. This was me reading books by myself, ingesting information by myself, looking at these ideas skeptically by myself and comparing them to other ideas that I was being presented and deciding that, based on the evidence, these ideas were correct. Not that they made me feel good. They made me nervous as all hell, in fact. Not that they made me feel warm and gushy inside. They made me think that life was going to be really difficult moving forward until I really integrated the philosophy. But looking at them and deciding that these had to be correct because no one was contradicting them, no one could find flaws in them, and they were the basis of all the flaws in all the other philosophies. So think for yourselves, people. That's the core here. What did Ayn Rand say? If there is one commandment, it's think for yourself. So that was a little bit of a Daniel rant.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. It's good. It's interesting that you actually heard about Rand from a professor, especially undergrad, because the way I came about it was I had just, what was that study that was publicized that it was the second most influential book. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, so there's this book that's influential and I've read the Bible, cause I had to read it in high school. We had a class that was like the Bible as literature. So I've read the Bible. Of course I grew up Catholic for like the first until like fourth grade or something. So how many years that is, what, 12 years of your life, 13, I don't know, whatever that is. And then I just had a summer between grad school where I wasn't doing anything. I was like, I'm going to read this book that's like influential that people seem to like. And then I just completely read it on my own. So I think that experience right there just shows the way I contradicted the groups that were around me. And just to sort of do the same thing really briefly, I think sort of the big things for me are threefold, maybe, or fourfold. The first thing is, obviously, I was raised Catholic, but unconfirmed, so I could have very much internalized this Catholic guilt for life, you know, being Italian and Polish. I mean, I was in Poland around Easter. It doesn't get much more Catholic than that, and that was very familiar to me. And then being Italian as well, you don't get much more Catholic than that. So I very much could have internalized that. I grew up around the land of the Kennedys, as I like to call it. I mean, everyone was a leftist in Massachusetts growing up. Everyone. But then on the other hand, my dad is conservative to the point that he still supports Trump. He's one of these people who made that transition. I don't agree with him, but I am now to the point in my life that I can not agree with him and see the flaws in what he's saying. And even though I agree with a lot of what he says, I don't agree with that. And I see the way he's become collectivized without realizing it, even though he's the one who taught me to think for myself. And then I think the final thing is just being straight edge. I think the fact that I was willing to go against our general culture of drinking, and it's interesting to me that you didn't say that, Daniel, because that's something to me that is across no matter where I've lived in American culture. I just get so tired of this mentality that people have. They show up, they're carrying beer and they're drinking it. They go to the place, they drink beer. Then when they're eating dinner, they drink beer. And just the fact that that's the main mode of socializing and the main mode of interacting with reality, the fact that I haven't shows that I've chosen my own values and I've chosen my own life rather than just done what's around me.
I like beer.
I'm not saying not liking beer. I know you're making a reference to Kavanaugh,
but
I'm not saying the problem is liking beer. I'm saying it's, did you hear the way I described it? They carry beer with them. Now imagine if I did that with like Swiss cake rolls from Walmart. I always had a box with me. Like I ate it before I left. I ate it when I got to the place. I ate it at the place. I then ate it at dinner.
You couldn't talk to other humans unless you had Swiss cake rolls.
Right, exactly.
When you went to places and they didn't have Swiss cake rolls, you were like, oh, this is lame.
Yeah, we have to make sure before we go to this place they have Swiss cake rolls.
That's right. At the end of the night, you're just downing Swiss cake rolls as fast as you can before they kick you out. Like, now I need more.
That's probably the best use of reductio ad absurdum ever, but that's the way it is for me. And that's the point. I'm just trying to demonstrate that you can be an individual and you can choose your own values. I will advocate for straight edge, but you don't have to be straight edge. But
yeah, I didn't drink till grad school. You know that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. First beer after that rhetoric class with Professor Cynthia Haynes, who argued that bees engage in rhetoric. And I just couldn't, like, my mind was blown to the point where I just turned to a fellow student and said, please take me drinking. So
they got you. That's how
they got me. That's right. They broke me down. Speaking of breaking people down, the crowdfunding site Patreon is purging, quote, right-wing figures, end quote. Uh-oh, Justin. Uh-oh. So this is from Vice News.
Before you continue, because you already went in that direction, when I read this, that was my first reaction. I was like, uh-oh, because I'm always worried we're going to be confused for far-right figures. But then even in this episode, just the way we've been talking about it shows how we're not. And then the fact that we haven't been purged and we weren't shadow banned like I originally thought made me realize, hey, you know, maybe we're doing a better job than I realized.
Or we're just not that important.
Yeah, that's where everything starts with me is my low self-esteem. I go, it's a really good thing nobody pays attention to me because I would be banned from all these sites already. And then I get really angry because these people who have worse content than me are being banned. And I go, why does everyone pay attention to them? Why does nobody like me? What's wrong with me? Good thing that's I'm right. Straight edge because I'd be drunk right now.
Yeah, I like beer. Crowdfunding site Patreon this week banned the accounts of several controversial public figures, part of a wider push by tech companies to de-platform users linked to the alt-right and far-right. The account of British conspiracy theorist YouTuber Carl Benjamin, that is a bunch of compound nominals that any good English teacher would have shied them away from. The account of a British conspiracy theorist YouTuber, Carl Benjamin, better known as Sargon of Akkad, was removed Tuesday. This followed the removal in August of U.S. far-right political commentator James Alsop. The ban will be a particular blow for Benjamin. Is it that I can't read or this is so poorly written, Justin?
False dichotomy, bro.
Okay. Who was earning more than $12,000 a month from the crowdfunding site. He did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Benjamin's ban came a day after far right-wing activist Milo Yiannopoulos saw his account killed just 24 hours after he set it up to fund a, quote, magnificent 2019 comeback tour. The former Breitbart editor was cut off because of his association with far-right group Proud Boys, Patreon said. So Patreon has basically said that if you are associated with these far-right groups, that is a violation of their terms. What do they say specifically? You cannot associate or support violent organizations, end quote. So this seems to be a new trend, not just for Patreon, but for basically the entire internet. I think it was Tim Cook, not Steve Jobs, Tim Cook this week said that it was their moral obligation, basically, to deplatform people who violated their core beliefs. So I think this is going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. What say you?
Oh yeah, this is a precursor to the Civil War. This is completely a precursor to the Civil War, because what you're going to start doing is create have and have not groups based upon collectivist groups. And because of that, the only way that can end is violence. Can you imagine that if anyone who voted for Trump isn't allowed to use an iPhone? I mean, that's the logical conclusion of this.
It's at least a reductio conclusion that may not be so much absurdum.
Yeah, it's definitely not absurd. I could totally see them doing it when you register, like, what are your political beliefs? Or cross-checking with the national database for how you're registered to vote. Or
this yeah, is I mean, they can look at – they everyone who votes – I don't know if you know this, you have an FEC, Federal Election Commission profile. Like, people can know how you voted.
Yeah.
So, you could have access to that.
Ladies and gentlemen, don't vote. I mean, the system's broken. Not only are these people stuffing ballots on both sides of the aisle, they're now using it to track you. We're going to talk about Facebook and Russian collusion and how they're using all this data that if you talk about something, an ad pops up on your computer. Still not going to convince me that that's not crazy. I have a wiretapping device. I gave in. I know they're tracking everything I'm doing on Alexa right now. Jeff Bezos and his giant head right now is tracking me. So not only are they doing that, but when you vote, the government's creating a profile of how to herd you like cattle. I'm starting to sound, you know I'm in trouble because I'm starting to sound like, what's that guy's name?
Alex Jones.
No, not Alex Jones. Oh. The Stefan Molyneux. I'm starting to sound like Stefan Molyneux, where we're all treated like chattel. But he has a point, and the point is, don't vote, because the system is flawed. Until the system is fixed to have this digital tracking of the votes actually happen, and actually happen in a way that protects the voter, as the system is supposed to be by the people and for the people, don't vote. All you're doing is making it harder on yourself. And this is a prime example of how. Look, I agree that private companies should be able to refuse service to whoever they want for whatever reason they want. But culturally, what does it say if we're going to start denying service just because they disagree with us on some non-essential issue that we're considering a core belief? We don't define core beliefs anymore. Everything is a core belief, and that's the problem. If you contradict anything at all, it's a core belief. Is gun control a core belief? They would treat it like it was.
This is the problem with politics becoming everything. And what I mean by that in particular is not the sort of philosophy of politics becoming everything, with literally the job of the politic becoming everything, i.e. the government being all powerful. The more power we give to government, be it local, state, federal, whatever it is, the more everything does become a core belief in a certain sense. I get where this comes from, because there's so much at stake. Because we continually give the government the more the power to affect our lives, to force us to do things based on what, you know, let's call it 60%, but really 51% of the people want. And the more we allow them to do that, the more we give up, the more we decide that we shouldn't be in control of, but that someone else should be in control of, the higher the stakes are, of course. When the government can force us to buy health care, what is that, 10 years ago now? Imagine what they're going to be able to do 10 years from now, from this point.
You know how you stop that, Daniel?
Stop voting?
Correct, because votes are money for the government. Look, I mean, I know ultimately the job is, their goal is to tax us, right? But yeah. At the base of it, if you want a company to stop doing business, you stop doing business with them, right? You stop buying their products. You stop going to their restaurants. You stop watching ESPN because of Deflategate, right? You do things. It's the same thing with the government. If you do not want them to do these things anymore, stop voting. That's the only thing that gives them power. It legitimizes the system every time you vote for them. And that is why they have these pushes, especially on the left, that you need to go out and vote. Because they're saying you need to go out and vote because we need you to, at the very least, just by casting a vote, even if you vote no for everything, you're still voting for the legitimacy of the system when you show up to the polling places. And that's why they want you to do it. Because even though they're doing it because they want you to vote leftist, they at the very least know that by showing up, you're voting for government and you're voting for the current system.
Well, that's all very depressing. To bring it back a little bit to the core topic here, I have two things to maybe get your reaction to. One is a sort of dystopian.
Don't vote. That's my reaction.
One is sort of a dystopian version of this, which is how far does quote-unquote deplatforming go? And what I mean is, you know, you said you can't use an iPhone because you're a Trump voter, but is Whole Foods going to reject selling you a hamburger because you voted for Trump?
Yes, that's why I'm saying you go the to only the way Shell this station, ends the Civil War.
Will you not be able to fill up your car because you don't like gay marriage?
Yes.
I mean, how is that sustainable in any way?
It's not. It can only end in violence because what you have is your in-groups and your out-groups, and then you have to live with your in-groups and out-groups, and then you start fighting over resources because you're not willing to trade with the other groups. It can only end in violent war.
Well, more depressing. The second least depressing thing is that this has caught the attention, specifically the Patreon deplatforming of Sargon of Akkad. Is that how you say that? Akkad? I don't know. Has caught the attention of both Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin, who have sent out messages in the past few days, because they both make a significant amount of money on Patreon, saying essentially that this is ridiculous and that they're really not going to stand for it, and that they are looking into creating their own content-neutral Patreon-like platform. So maybe something good will come of this, but the sort of that goes back to the first point, which is how many, like, what sort of dual society do we need to live in that this sort of crap needs to be combated? But we'll see. I don't know.
Well, even them creating it, that's sort of like Gab AI being created as the alternative to Twitter. It's just going to become a place where these extreme fringe people go, and that it's been going to be labeled alt-right is exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. So,
and I have a question about that, actually. That goes into the question I wanted to ask you about this, because we liked a lot of what Milo Yiannopoulos wrote, and we were fans of him. When did he become this extreme figure? And I'm saying that sort of facetiously because it doesn't seem like he changed and his views are all that extreme. I mean, besides the fact that he's a Trump supporter, right? That's probably the worst thing about what he thinks is I can't get behind his Trump support.
You don't remember the controversy that changed it all? I do. The controversy was him opening up about young gay sexuality.
Oh, I remember that controversy as a way of ostracizing him and making people see him as a pariah and not wanting to support him. But that translates to him being this fringe alt-right. And when they say the word alt-right, they're translating that to white supremacist, Nazi, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. I disagree with not all, but a significant portion of Milo Yiannopoulos' takes on things. But I don't think that means he should be ostracized from society. In many ways, the people who are on the fringe of ideas help us sort of clarify our own ideas about how things are and why I agree with, like, Nadine Strossen, who is the former president of the ACLU, who wrote a book recently about why we should combat quote-unquote hate speech with more speech. The idea being that speech that we disagree with, speech that hurts us or is hateful or is wrong or whatever, actually helps us understand what our ideas are and helps us understand what we consider to be the cultural norms of things. And without that, that's when we get true oppression and true things that are outside of the cultural norms, because essentially this equally bad stuff will just be validated because it's part of the quote-unquote in-group. So I want Yiannopoulos to be more out there. I want Sargon of Akkad to be more out there. I want these people who are considered alt-right to be more out there, not less out there. Don't create echo chambers. That's the worst thing we could do for our culture.
Well, right, and that's what I'm saying with this label of alt-right and acting like he's this extreme fringe figure. I mean, even when you look at someone like Jordan Peterson, I'm actually starting to see good arguments about Jordan Peterson out there against him and against what he says and his rhetorical style and his intellectual style. And I like that because then I can take the good things from Jordan Peterson and then dismiss the bad things because now I have the good arguments on both sides of it. And it's the same thing with Milo. Milo wrote some good stuff about the issues with sexuality in our current culture, and then he's had a lot of bad stuff, as you noted. But it seems we throw out the baby in the bathwater because of this collectivism and because of, as you said, these echo chambers where we just label people as extremists and then it's just everything about them, the good and the bad, is gone.
We don't even throw out the baby with the bathwater. We abort the baby and we never fill the bathwater. Like, we're to a point now where there's no baby in bathwater. It's, if you have anything that resembles ideas that we consider to be bad, that's it. Bye-bye. You're done. No more.
So long story short, we've been joking about being banned from the internet. It's getting closer and closer to actually us getting banned from the internet. So we will see.
Dear Midsiders, it is a lifelong goal of mine to be banned from the internet. So if we could make the show a little bit more popular, a little few more retweets, etc., and get the show up there, then we too could be banned. And that would just really make my life. So
I think I would end the show. I think if we got banned from a bunch of platforms, I would say we've reached the extreme, and I would put out a statement about how we've done everything we can with the show, and that ultimately us being banned proves the validity of the points we've been making. And if you want to understand why we're not continuing the show and why we were banned and why us being banned ultimately is a victory, then go back and listen to our X number of seasons of the show. I think that's what I would do if we were banned.
That's right. And I would retire to the Bahamas with all that Patreon money. So, speaking of money, we'll just go through this one quickly. California is proposing a plan to tax text messages. Because, of course, they are. This is essentially, it's not a per text tax. Are all of these articles written like this? But it essentially would be a tax for any service, phone service that carries a texting functionality, essentially, so like a flat tax. And it's in order to give more people access to phones and services that they otherwise wouldn't have. So California is being very altruistic with your money again. Justin, does this surprise you at all, or is this basically par for the course for the horrible state in which you live?
It doesn't surprise me, and for the sake of transparency, William did post in Discord that I guess the FCC said for some bureaucratic technicality they can't text messages because go ahead.
Kind of. I was going to get into that. I just wanted your horrible reaction to California first.
Oh, well, okay. I could just give that first. I just wanted to be intellectually honest before I rant.
We'll get there.
I mean, look. Anyone who is living in California who doesn't see this or who sees this and doesn't immediately think I need to get the fuck out of here is disconnected from reality. Okay, the fact that they would even think of doing this shows that they just see you as a bank account and they just see you, as I said in the last story, they just see you as cattle. They're just herding you in directions and figuring out how to get more money from you. Because not they have some social agenda where they're trying to help people. It's just that's how they survive. They survive by taking your money and redistributing it to themselves. That's what they are doing here. And all they're looking at is they're going, hey, what do people do most often? And what will people not notice? Oh, yeah, everyone texts. So if we hit them with a 40 cents tax per month, they won't notice. And that's another free 40 cents we get from them. And if you take 40 cents from everyone in California, that adds up. And that's what this entire state is based upon. It's based upon the idea of nickel and diming you in every area. And then they get the money and you can't get ahead. And it will continue to be that way because people look at this and they don't get outraged. When I read about this, when I was told about this, I was so angered, so incensed that they would even think about this. So maybe as you're going to go into, the FCC is saying it can't happen. But the fact that they would even think about taxing text messages shows there is no depth they won't go to. There's no place they won't go to. They're just sitting here trying to figure out ways to nickel and dime us without us realizing it.
Sometimes it's a dollar and dollar 50 you. Forget the nickel and dime crap. I wish it was nickels and dimes sometimes.
I was using the phrase nickel and
dime. I know. I'm being purposely obtuse. So
sometimes it's more than $1.50. How about the fact that I pay almost $300 a year for my car title registration?
For the privilege of driving in the great state of California.
For my $19,000 car, I have to pay $300 a year. Think about that for a second.
That's right. That's right. But it's the rich who are really screwing over the poor, Justin. You just remember that always. Okay, so
yeah, they are the rich because they took all our money. The government is the rich. They took all our money. They're saying that they're screwing us over because they have made themselves rich and made us poor. I mean, that's an accurate statement.
In a certain sense, yes. I would say that it's very Robin Hood-esque, but in the proper term. So the FCC ruled this week sort of coincidentally that, because I don't think they were trying to invalidate this California statute or this proposal. Sorry, it's not a statute yet. But the FCC ruled this week that text messages are an information service, more like email. They're doing that as a way to crack down on spam messages. But essentially what that means is that if it's an information service and not like a phone, like not like a technical service, that's kind of the difference, but not quite the difference. I'm not an expert here. But essentially that means that this California agency doesn't have authority over these messages and can't really add a surcharge onto them, at least in the way that this law was proposed in California. Do not mistake this for California going, oh, well, forget it then. We won't add a tax. They will find a way if they want to. They will find a way to make this legal. That's why they hire very expensive lawyers. They'll just jiggery-pokery some things around, and they'll say, well, we're not taxing this. We're taxing something else. And it just so happens to affect text messages, but it's not directly related to text messages. But please give us your money anyway. So don't worry, citizens of California. They will find a way to get your money. This is not the end.
It is not the end. And can I ask a question about this?
Sure.
So this is like the California Public Utilities or something saying they need to tax text messages to get more services for everyone else. Yes. That's the basic rationale.
Right.
Who in America in 2018 isn't texting? Like, is there some like oppressed group that like is textless that I don't know about?
Maybe. And if they are, they don't have a right to it, by the way. The government need not provide you with a texting service. So
I think they're better off for it.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, it makes me so angry.
Justin angry.
All right, let's move on to some things that maybe make us hopeful. It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on.
As I mentioned at the top of the episode, this is our last regular episode of the year. Next episode is our year-end awards, and we need your help. We need your nominations for the year-end awards. We need your vote for the Peak Farce Audience Award. So if you could help us out, go to themidside.com/awards and cast your votes now for next week's year-end award show. That's going to the – I'll probably close the votes on Friday or Saturday morning and count things and then talk to Daniel about who we want to give awards to. But again, that's themidside.com/awards. A couple quick reviews here. Daniel, I know you want to review Roman Empire Season 2. I just started Glow Season 2 because actually one of you Midsiders out there, one of your peers, submitted it for the Romantic Manifestation Award, and I remember I loved Season 1, and I'm about two episodes in, and I just want to say Glow is one of the most consistent shows I've ever seen. Every episode, and this is what I love about it, every episode has a point to it. there's a reason that episode is told, and it's not purely plot-based. There's some sort of thematic denouement in every episode, and that is something that's really missed in modern entertainment, modern storytelling, is stories are told just for the sake of explosions and Marvel making another dollar. But the Glow has artistic integrity. Now, I don't know if they're going to be able to continue this high level of quality, but I'm sure they'll continue with this artistic integrity, and I can appreciate it for that reason. They know what they're doing, and they have a purpose to what they're doing. They're not just perpetuating a show to get clicks, to get views, to get ratings, to get dollars. Go ahead with Roman Empire, Daniel.
Interesting. So Roman Empire, for those of you who haven't heard of it, which is probably most of you, is a Netflix original show that is giving the history of, wait for it, the Roman Empire. But it's doing it in a way that's trying to appeal to two of their growing audiences. One is their growing documentary audience, and one is their growing audience of people who want more Game of Thrones type content. So how do you mash those two things up? Well, you do a show that is half drama, half actual documentary. So what I mean by this is the show literally has scenes that are dramatized like you would watch any dramatic show, and then it cuts to interviews with experts like professors at universities and whatnot, sort of explaining more in depth what's going on. So I was sort of fascinated by the concept. Season one was not great. It was sort of about the last Roman emperor, and that wasn't particularly interesting of a story, and it was very haphazardly done. I tuned into season two because I was still a little bit hopeful for the genre, even though it was a very weird genre. And I was pleasantly surprised, but still somewhat let down. So season two is about the rise of Julius Caesar to power, and then eventually to absolute power, and then his death. Spoiler alert. And the problem with something like Roman Empire, or where you're trying to mix sort of the literal dramatic and the literal factual, is that they tend to do neither particularly well. So the dramatic scenes sometimes come off as cheesy, and they don't quite hit. I don't know if it's because they're hiring terrible actors or terrible writers or whatever. And then the documentary scenes come off as way too expository, like they're just trying to push a story forward as opposed to actually give you the essentialized information about that given thing. So what ends up happening is that you don't feel totally satisfied with either element of this concept. But still, despite being disappointed now for two seasons, I'm somewhat interested in this genre, Justin. What is it? Give me the psychological explanation for myself that makes me so interested in this mixed format genre.
My first question before I even go into that is, isn't this already the true crime genre, where you watch a show, a network like A&E or True TV, or I think True TV used to be Court TV, but they would do the dramatic reenactment of the scenes, and then they would have the people who actually lived them give interviews and expository comments about dramatic reenactions? Isn't that the same genre?
Kind of. I don't think I put a point on this, or maybe I just left it in my head accidentally. It's not that these scenes are reenactments of what is being said by the documentarians. These are scenes that are clearly drama, in that we're seeing the inner workings of people's heads, we're seeing choices that they make that aren't in the explanation. So they're trying to do a show so that it's not a reenactment. They're trying to do a show, and then these documentarians are giving other information. It's just that the other information tends to be too expository, I think. So I think it comes from that, you're right, but I think it's a new genre in that they're trying to do both a show and a documentary in the same time span.
I mean, this is the same reason that time travel stories even exist. The idea of being able to go back in time and be a witness, be a fly on the wall to what actually happened is what's so appealing. This is what's standing out to you here is you want the humanization of the information. So you want to learn, and you want to learn what actually happened, but you also want at the same time to know what it was like, the reality of that. Because, you know, when we say things like the winners write history and things like that, everything that's in books and are just facts and we just learn these things, there's a mind-body dichotomy in them where they say, yeah, this is what happened. And then they'll totally also say, this is what the ideas are. But there's never really the connection to understand, like, who George Washington was as a person, or who James Madison was as a person. Or even, I mean, the example for me is Thomas Jefferson. Like, the advantage of going to Monticello is you get that mind-body dichotomy goes away as much as it possibly can. You understand Thomas Jefferson as a complete human being when you go there and you learn all of these intimate details about him and you see how he actually lived. That's the value of going to these places where history actually happened. You're seeing the reality of it. And the closest thing we can get to that in a story, in an entertainment medium, is exactly what you're describing.
I think you nailed it. I had very similar thoughts to why this is interesting to me, because I love documentaries. They're increasingly my favorite genre of art, cinematic art at the moment, because of how bad dramatic film has gotten. But when I watch documentaries about modern things that include video, like, I feel fully fulfilled by those. But when I watch documentaries about, let's just call it ancient things, even though all I mean is sort of predating video, there's always a detachment there. There's always a sense of, I'm an outside observer, and these aren't humans. And so I think the drama of this is an attempt to make them humans. It's an attempt to allow me to use the epistemological language, to induce what is so interesting about them, as instead of to deduce what is interesting about them, i.e. to observe it instead of just be told what it is. So I find that fascinating. I just don't think they're nailing it yet, but I have hopes that this is a genre that continues to grow, and some people really take this on as a maybe niche for now, but maybe bigger art form into the future. It's just that Roman Empire isn't quite it.
That's a really long-winded way to call me a genius.
I have to go around the bend because I'd never say the words.
I would refer to an old cartoon to say how this should be done in its ideal way. Oh, are you ready?
Okay.
Peabody and Mr. Sherman. Or did I mix that up? Mr. Peabody and Sherman. Sorry, I said that backwards. Mr. Peabody and Sherman. That is very much what this show is. And that's what I would do. I would have it be time travel. I would have your host, your narrator, be a time traveler like Mr. Peabody or like Sherman or even like Scrooge McDuck, right? That's sort of the appeal of DuckTales for me when I was a kid, is they would go and they would, even in the new show, they have Storkules, right? They would literally go and interact with Hercules and Zeus, and you'd learn about it, but they'd also be real people. And there was a show by the Animaniacs creators called Hysteria, which did a similar thing as well. So that's the direction I would go with it, where you have a narrator who is like, hey, let's go on a journey, and we go on a journey to learn about these things. And that's the best episodes of Doctor Who for me as well, where he takes his companions and they say, where do you want to go in history? And they go and they meet Van Gogh. And then you have this deeply moving episode about Van Gogh's psychology and the way he was as a person. And yeah, it's deeply romanticized, but if you combine that romanticization with Doctor Who being a narrator rather than an involved person, he's sort of like a tour guide, I think you could use that as a framing device to really make this happen better. Because right now it just seems like the way you're describing it is it's very, the mind-body disconnect still there. Even though they're trying to put them together, it sounds like it jumps from one art form to the other rather than having being integrated.
That's right. It feels very left brain, right brain, but not simultaneous brain.
All right, very interesting. And after we just sort of tore that apart and said where things should go, I think we can continue to do that with Trailer Takedown as we talk about some movies that are about to come out here As always, if you want to watch the trailers ahead of time, they're on the midside.com/podcast. They usually put them up like Friday or Saturday. You can watch them before the episode. Before you listen to the episode, you can listen to them during the episode. You can listen to them after the episode. However you choose, you could even alternate. We talk about a movie, you watch the trailer. We talk about a movie, you watch the trailer. So you can always know what's going on. TheMidside.com/podcast.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
King of Thieves is a Michael Caine-led movie that seems to be a cross between Red and Ocean's 11. Do you know what I mean when I say both of those, Daniel?
Yes. Red was about all the retired agents, right?
Right. And then Ocean's 11 is Bruce Willis, Morgan Freeman.
And then Ocean's 11 is a heist film. So,
right. Yeah. This is supposedly
that's
about
the pitch.
The big, yeah, exactly. They were like, what if we got an Oscar winner to star in this movie? Would it make it more palatable? For me, no. So this is supposed to be a comedy about old people committing a crime and then turning on each other. And they seem to be going comedically in this trailer. But I was just like, why is Michael Caine in this? And what's with all the generic old white dudes? Like, I literally couldn't tell any of these people apart. Like, it doesn't even pass the visual sniff test of, like, movies should be visually interesting. And, you know, I'm not saying diversity for diversity's sake, but, like, I don't know. Dress your characters up a little differently. Make them characters. Don't
just
make
them
British people.
So British. Let's make them all look exactly the same and put them all in the exact same clothes.
Yeah, it's just tackle.
But we'll give them different British accents so people will be able to tell them apart. You did an interesting thing this week where you were very close, Justin. For the first in a long time of giving me a hug sweep. Now, I know that gives a little bit away about the next few trailers, so spoiler alert there. But I didn't know if you were going on purpose for genres that I particularly liked.
Yes.
So the genre that this hits closest to that I particularly like is just sort of old-school British comedy. Now, it's structured around this heist plot, which is apparently based on a true story. I'm always somewhat skeptical when it says based on a true story, because they can take sort of the most minute elements of something and turn it into a total fiction and say it was based on a true story. So I'm curious to actually
like
know
the Bible.
How much of a true story. That's right. Exactly. Exact same thing. No difference whatsoever. Michael Caine leads the Bible as well. So like, I like the repartee of this, but it kind of bothers me that it's centered around this quasi weird action heist film. You're right. Michael Caine seems way out of place in this comparatively. One of the core things that I actually really like about British comedies is that I usually don't know anyone who's in them. Now, that's simply because I'm an ignorant American and I'm sure all these actors are huge in Britain. But nonetheless, I have to tackle this out of sheer annoyance with the plot structure, I think. And then, but otherwise I kind of like the concept of a bunch of old British guys bickering about something. Even if they were reflecting, I think, on their old days as being thieves, and there was a slightly different plot structure here and they weren't trying to do a new heist, I think I would like that better as a concept. Now, I'm being a little bit of an audience reconstructivist here, which I typically don't like, but it's just not something I can get into. So, tackle.
It does set up, I think, though, if you like British guys arguing about things, I think that sets up the next trailer quite well.
Second trailer.
Brexit is the HBO movie starring Benedict Cumberbatch about the guy, apparently, the one guy, apparently, and I'm tipping my hand already, the one guy who made Brexit happen. I can't, Daniel. I put this trailer and I put the next one in because I figured you'd like them, but I can't. I watch this movie, this trailer, and all I see is an agenda hack job. All I see is, oh, we're going to try and make it seem like the right wing has done this crazy shit to hack society. That's why that people support them. Oh, we want to make it seem like they're not real. Even though everything in the trailer they say the right wing is doing is everything they've been doing to try and get ahead. and they're trying to attribute to them to demonize them. I see this no different than the Russian collusion storyline with Trump. I see a movie coming out with that later, and it's the same thing here. It's just so dishonest to me and so disconnected from reality that they're sitting there and they're going, oh, hey, there's this one guy who led this movement. And it wasn't a movement of people legitimately having a problem with something like the European Union.
So that's a
tackle. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, in case that wasn't obvious.
Well, sometimes people go in weird directions. Even if I agreed with everything you said, and I agree with 78% of it, I think, about this trailer, I would still watch this film because it is in my wheelhouse. It is in the most niche version of my wheelhouse. So my general wheelhouse is political thriller, which is the best ever for me. People in rooms talking about politics. For whatever reason, that is a thing I will watch no matter what.
So you like the show Billions?
They're not talking politics, okay. Funny enough. When I mean politics, I mean they literally have to be talking politics. It does not transport to me for other genres, and I don't know why.
What's the 22% you disagree with?
That I think that I agree that this will be a hack job, but I think that it will be presented in a way that a viewer who had any intellectual honesty could say, I understand they're trying to present a hack job, but I actually kind of get what was going on here. The trailer, while I think it tried to set this up as something that was bad, I think failed at it, because if they're just presenting any of the basic facts of the story, they're going to see that this was actually a grassroots movement that people, to put it a different way, there are sometimes grassroots movements that never go anywhere because those people can't connect with each other. And I think the interesting thing about Brexit is that whether it's one guy or a group or whatever behind the scenes, helped these disparate communities connect with each other so they could actually have a movement. And I think that was what was fascinating about Brexit to me, and what's fascinating about this film. But to be clear, the niche version of the genre that I like is British people in rooms talking about politics, which I will watch all day and all night. Yes, Minister... The Thick of It, all those shows are just gold for me. So this is a total hug. And I also like, I told you, this other genre of sort of HBO's immediate documentary types of things. Documentaries about things that have happened more recently. And I am not at all joking when I say they must unequivocally be already producing the Mueller investigation documentary. Because they're going to want to have it out the moment this thing is wrapped up, I suspect. So they've got to be, if not in, you know, past scripting into like casting already.
Yeah, it's like episodes of Law and Order that are ripped from the headlines.
That's right.
Final trailer.
An Acceptable Loss is a political thriller starring Jamie Lee Curtis and some woman I've never heard of about the aftermath of a nuclear strike. It looks like there's a foreign policy meeting. They decide to strike a country. And then, I guess, I don't know why we're retelling World War II. Like, this seems very strange to me. I guess this woman who was okay with the bombing stops being okay with the bombing after it happened, so she has this guilt. That's why I'm saying World War II. This seems like a dramatic retelling of the guilt over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which changed our country in ways that we've seen the effects of, especially recently. For me, I just don't care. I don't care. Like, you were involved in it, you're not. I don't care what your life is afterwards. I don't want to watch people within the government, because it becomes a part where Jamie Lee Curtis starts threatening her, and there's all these like behind the back dealings and threats, and like, is she a traitor? Is she a patriot? Is she Edward Snowden? Is she in House of Cards? I don't know what's going on. I don't care. This is not interesting to me. Like, it's more interesting to me what the war was, why the bomb happened, what that conflict was over, than these petty people doing these things behind the scenes. I don't care. But this is also why I don't vote. So I'm also going to not vote for this by tackling it.
Tackle.
You know who this is interesting to? A twofer this week on political thrillers. I'll say that this one doesn't interest me as much as the British one, partially because this turns into an action thriller, and you start to lose me at action. When I mean I want people in rooms talking about politics, that means I don't want them to do anything else, including shoot at each other. But so this comes a little bit of an action film here at the end, which makes it a little less exciting for me. But I will absolutely watch this. I think the trailer hinted at but didn't do a good job of portraying that this woman, Tika Sumpter, I think is her name, who plays the National Security Advisor, was sort of coerced into being okay with the bombing, or at least given misinformation which made her okay with the bombing, and sort of what do you do with that afterwards, to me, is an interesting sort of insight, insofar as I like films that, I don't want to say necessarily demonize actions that the government does, but sort of takes a critical look at the decisions that government officials make, especially when they're in secrecy. I like that in particular. So this is a hug for me, a little bit less of an enthusiastic hug than the last one, but nonetheless, you have given me two films now to watch, Justin. And you, having rejected them all, must now pick which one you would watch if forced.
I was hoping you wouldn't remember that.
Oh, no.
Because it would be a slog to get through any of these. So on one hand, there's value in watching the Brexit movie because it's like, let's see what they did with this. But I know what they're going to do with it. So the least offensive one of all of these is the Michael Caine one. So I would just watch that because I could just be like, oh, here's a stupid movie about British old dudes committing a heist.
British old dudes. They get you every time.
You know who gets us every time and is an old dude? Bill Belichick.
Oh.
Bill Let's Belichick. Go into a secret, special, surprise edition of Belichick Your Premises.
Go talk to the geniuses that are online. What was the condition to rule and control? The media sells it, and you leave the role.
Metal wounds still screaming, driving me insane. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train. It's time to Belichick Your Premises, recorded during the Sunday morning games, or Sunday afternoon if you're on the East Coast. I just said the intro backwards because it's been so long since I've done it. Some of these games this morning, though, there's not really anything interesting. We got the Bears up 7 on the Packers, but the Packers are terrible. The Bengals and the Raiders are tied. The Colts are beating the Cowboys 7-0. That's kind of interesting. The Vikings are up 14-0 on the Dolphins. Fuck the Dolphins. Not really any interesting games because the interesting games have sort of already happened this week. I mean, the big one obviously is we got Steelers-Patriots coming up after we finish recording. So I don't want to go too much into all of that because you will be hearing this episode after the game. So there's sort of a weird time thing there. But we had the big one on Thursday night, the Chargers and the Chiefs. That was probably the biggest one. And then we had the Texans won yesterday against the Jets. So let's talk about for a second here, Chargers and Chiefs. Mm-hmm. Daniel, I know that I texted you the next day and you said you had the same problem with the Chiefs-Rams game where you went to sleep and the Chiefs were winning and then you woke up and had lost.
Hold on. No. Chargers-Steelers.
Oh, Chargers-Steelers. Sorry. Oh, yes. So Chargers, yes.
Because I have now twice gone to bed at halftime with the Chargers getting their butts whooped and woken up with the Chargers winning the game. And I am not used to this.
On the Chargers.
I literally slept on the Chargers twice. And I'm having an existential crisis because these are not the Chargers I am used to. The Chargers I am used to are leading at halftime and then tend to blow major leads at the very end when Philip Rivers just throws a wobbler and it's taken back for a pick six. What is going on here? Is this a renaissance for Philip Rivers, who, statistically speaking, is one of the better performing quarterbacks of the Super Bowl era, but who has not had success? Or is this a fluke? Is this something that's going to disappear into the ether and we'll never think about it again after this season?
Would this be an acceptable use of false dichotomy, bro?
Of course it is.
It's both. So every quarterback, and this is about to come up in a second when I say Joe Flacco, every quarterback has their really good season, right? I mean, Joe Flacco had his. They won the Super Bowl. He got millions of dollars for it. And this is Phillip Rivers' really good season. Kudos to him. Hats off to him. He's playing with a load of confidence. He's playing with a load of momentum. He's playing well for Phillip Rivers. But the other side of this is these games that you're talking about are teams that are overrated and not that good and don't have what it takes to win when it matters. And I know I just said that about the Chiefs, so people are going to freak out. But first, let's just mention the Steelers, right? The Steelers, over the past few years, have been on a downward spiral. If I were them, I would have gotten rid of Mike Tomlin a while ago. I think he's lost control of the team. I don't think they have a good psychology, and it manifests in games like that. They've always been inconsistent over the past few seasons, wildly inconsistent. And then when they play a game that matters, such as that AFC Championship game in New England a couple years ago we went to, they just completely shit the bed. So it's not surprising that when you put Phillip Rivers, who's playing the season of his career, up against the Steelers, that would happen. Then the Chiefs. Let's get real about the Chiefs for a second, okay? Are they athletically gifted? Are they the skill positions? Are they super talented? Yes, but who is their coach? Andy Reid. What is Andy Reid known for? He's known for losing when it matters. And then they have a second-year quarterback who, again, I like Mahomes. He's a good guy, right? There was the picture circulating of him at the Sporting KC MLS playoff game. He's, by all accounts, a good guy. He's a good player. He's someone who should see success for a long term in this league. But every game that has mattered that the Chiefs have played, they lost. They lost to the Patriots. They lost to the Rams. They lost to the Chargers. How does that speak well of their ability to win at a big game? It doesn't. So again, it's not surprising that a veteran quarterback, and this is something I've said before, a veteran quarterback this year in a transition year, and we're going to talk about this again in a second, would be able to come out on top. And that's what I think ultimately will happen in the Super Bowl this season. I think we'll see someone like a Rivers, a Breeze, or a Brady win the Super Bowl, because I don't think these young kids yet can handle the spotlight. I don't think they can yet handle the pressure. So I think ultimately that experience is what will win out in the playoffs. And as far as Phillip Rivers, he's still making those mistakes that he always makes because he's an idiot. He just doesn't have the brains. It's just they're not as damaging because of the other teams and because of how well he's playing otherwise. So in the Chiefs game, he hit this amazing pass to Benjamin down the middle on a third and long. Then on the next play, he got the running back open. The running back did a wheel route into the end zone, and he was open, and Phillip Rivers just underthrew him. There was no reason to. It was just a pure mental mistake. For some reason, he underthrew him. And that's what I mean when he just doesn't have the brains. And when it comes down to it in a tough game, when you get to the AFC divisional round or the AFC championship, or even if they get to the Super Bowl, he's going to make one of those mistakes, and that's going to cost them, in the same way when Peyton Manning threw that pick six against the Saints in the Super Bowl. And that's the difference between winning it all and losing, where we saw even last season where Shaq Mason gave up that sack, and even though Brady had that phenomenal game in the Super Bowl, the Patriots lost. So Phillip Rivers is still the same. It's just he's playing better than he's ever played in his ability. I don't see him winning. But then again, I didn't see Joe Flacco winning, and things broke in his favor. So if things break in his favor, Phillip Rivers could win the Super Bowl. I don't think it's likely.
So I think there's a theme coming out here before we get to the transition point about consistency that I think is really important, because we've talked about this in years past, but it's good to revisit it a little bit, certainly in light of this transition season, which is that one of the most, I don't want to call it underrated, but one of the values that people talk about the least, I think, is consistency. And why consistency is so important, and that is consistency on the micro level, consistency on the macro level. So consistency down to play execution, consistency down to a phrase like, I don't know, do your job, and consistently doing your job and so that other people can count on you. Consistency in game planning, consistency in clock management, consistency in the energy level that you use throughout a game. One of the reasons that the Patriots continue to be good, for instance, is that they play teams who will give for lack of a better metaphor, 150% in the first quarter, 100% in the second quarter, 75% in the third quarter, and 50% in the fourth quarter, but the Patriots have given an even amount throughout. And thus, they will usually come out ahead because they're not exhausting themselves, for instance. So even consistency in how you use your energy throughout a game tends to be important. And the thing that I want to emphasize about the consistency point here is that Philip Rivers is still playing inconsistently. It's just that he is coming out ahead on what many bettors would call the coin flip moments of these games. The problem with that is, eventually the coin flip catches up with you, or it doesn't. I.e., as you mentioned earlier, Joe Flacco, who the year he won the Super Bowl, won basically every coin flip opportunity that he took, especially coin flips when he was just essentially lobbing the ball down the field and hoping someone would catch it. So obviously, if you have pure luck, you can win any time, but usually those coin flips will take care of you.
Catch up with you. Or build a franchise. So it's interesting that you said you went to where I was going to go with it, with the whole do your job thing. You could argue that that's Bill Belichick's entire philosophy. If we play consistently through 60 minutes, odds are we will win most of our games. And that has been vetted out in reality. Now, yes, that creates a problem. The only problem and the only way to beat this is through the outlier events. We saw it in Miami last week. That was an outlier event. Statistically, they had won that game. The odds of them losing that game was extremely small, to the point that everybody knew it. You know, everybody, like I said, at Hooters, when they were talking to me, was like, you guys won. But I knew that in Miami, those things, those outlier events tend to happen. Outlier events are the only way to beat them. That's why, you know, Midsider Michael asked me this morning, how are you feeling about the Steelers game? And I said, you know, I don't think the Steelers are very good, as I've already mentioned on this episode, but they're due to beat us. And what I mean by that is we have just beaten them like a drum over how many years? And it's in Heinz Field. And then last year there was the whole thing with the catch by Heath Miller. Was it a catch? Was it not a catch? Blah, blah, blah. Gronk went off in the fourth quarter and we won. So it seems like statistically at some point the outlier event of them beating us has to happen. Now, I'm a little paranoid after last week in the Miami Miracle, which is an argument against that outlier happening, because outlier events don't tend to happen multiple times in a row. But that's the ultimate point, is that's not how you build a franchise. That's not how you build a career. That's not how you build a life. You build it on consistency, so then when the outlier events happen, you can weather that storm. Whereas most franchises, when an outlier event happens in a game, like you get two punts blocked against you, you just fold and you go, well, we're not coming back from this. It's not, you know, often that a team like Miami does what they did. Usually when you get two punts blocked, that's the end of it. Or if they're like, you throw four interceptions, then you usually lose. I mean, that's why the Steelers are the opposite of the Patriots in many ways, is they kind of embrace that inconsistency.
They do. It's much more, as the great Dave Damashek put it, a gunslinger mentality, which is why he likes watching the Steelers, because he likes the sort of thrill of not knowing what's going to happen and the thrill of the throwing it up in the air and then someone just running and making the catch, as opposed to the consistent methodical. He compares it to a surgeon versus gunslinger, that he would call the Patriots surgeon-esque, for instance. But I think the outlier point and the consistency point have a corollary relationship, insofar as, and this might be obvious, but I'll say it anyway, the less consistent you are, the more likely an outlier is to happen.
Yes.
So last week, the Patriots made some uncharacteristically inconsistent mistakes. I think the biggest of which was not the two missed extra points or field goals or extra points by Gostkowski, whatever they were.
They missed an extra point and a field goal.
There you go. The two missed kicks by Gostkowski, which are uncharacteristic. But I think the biggest one actually was Tom Brady taking a sack.
Yeah.
And that was an inconsistency that is so outside the norm for Tom Brady and the Patriots that it led to this Miami Miracle being what it was. Even if they had kicked a field goal there, the Miami Miracle would not have mattered. So the point
being
that...
I remember I said that actually, and a friend of mine, he texted me after the game. He screenshotted my text and he sent it back to me after the Miami Miracle because of exactly what you just said, because he knew it. And I said after, you know, the beginning of the third quarter, I said, we may have blown the game at the end of the first half. And he texted that back to me and he was like, you were right. And that's exactly why I said it. Like, we don't make those mistakes. And when you make those mistakes, you're opening yourself up to lose. Plus, those mistakes were compounded by the fact that they missed the extra point and the field goal. All of those things compounded into creating the outlier event. The only thing that even kept the game from being even more extreme of an outlier event was the two blocked punts.
Yes.
Which are outlier events in themselves. Two blocked punts in one game?
Right. So, all that being said, this point, I think, goes to the fact that we're seeing some inconsistency in the league overall this year that has created some excitement because of all the rookie quarterbacks. I was trying to recount them to Justin earlier before the show, and I was sort of amazed in my own recounting that there are so many of them that they are playing both at this incredibly high level and an incredibly low level, meaning statistically all of them are like on the bottom of the pack in terms of numbers for QBs, but they're also leading very exciting comebacks and the Browns beating the Broncos and Baker Mayfield looking like the future of that team, et cetera. But I don't know, Justin, if you can help me here. The rookies this year are Mayfield, Josh Allen, Josh Rosen, Sam Darnold, who looked pretty good for the Jets versus the Texans, although flubbed it in the end. And then as of the recording of this, a report coming out that's saying that Joe Flacco will not be returning to the Ravens next year, meaning that Lamar Jackson will now be the permanent starting quarterback. So that's five rookie starting quarterbacks out of 32 teams. And then, of course, you have Patrick Mahomes, who is only in his second year, who's not really a rookie, but...
And Jared Goff is what, third year?
Something like that. Yeah, and Mitch Trubisky, second year. So yeah. You have a very young class of quarterbacks all coming in who are playing at very interesting levels. Dak Prescott, as well, you could probably throw into that group, who are playing at these very interesting levels that are both high and then at times very low. That inconsistency, though, will probably even out, and eventually you will see this class being the next generation of all-stars. What say you about this transition?
It depends on what you define as class being the next all-stars. I agree that the consistency will level out, but it may level out that they're consistently bad as well. That tends to happen with young quarterbacks. So I don't want to anoint any of these quarterbacks yet. Baker Mayfield's an interesting case because he seems to play inconsistently, but they keep winning. I will always err on the side of a quarterback who just happens to win, even if his stats are bad, because I think that's the biggest thing. I don't know how you didn't mention Deshaun Watson.
Oh, of course. Sorry. Yeah. This is sort of like the end of his rookie season in the sense that he only played, what, half of last season?
Right. So. And he just broke some record where he has like 5,000 yards and like a certain amount of touchdowns. And I don't know what the record was. It was on his Instagram or on someone's Instagram. So he's doing really well. And he just wins. I may be biased, but I probably think him and Goff are probably the best of the class. And as I said, Patrick Mahomes, you'd be remiss to mention him. What we're seeing, though, with the league is finally they're embracing the idea of what I said. I don't know. Did I say it last season or have I said it to you before we were doing Belichick Your Premises? But if I were an NFL GM, because of it being such a quarterback-driven league, I would just take chances on these young kids and I would give them 2 to 3 years to play and prove themselves and prove that they can develop that consistency and play on that level. Because the number one thing in the NFL is developing a quarterback. If you can't develop a consistent quarterback, you can't win. Even if your quarterback isn't amazing statistically, if he's just consistent and you have a good defense, like with Trent Dilfer and the Ravens when they won back in the day, you still have a chance to win. So what we're seeing now is this tipping point. And Talib may appreciate me saying that, right? Was he the guy who wrote The Tipping Point?
Oh, no. Malcolm Gladwell.
Malcolm Gladwell may appreciate me saying this, but we're at the tipping point where people are looking at Brady and Breeze and Rivers, and now Peyton Manning's retired, and Eli Manning is much more bad Eli now than he is good Eli. And there's, I mean, if you want a case of consistency and outlier events in one human being, it's Eli Manning. They're all getting old now, and these teams are going, well, shit, we need to take chances on these young kids. And they're starting to do it. And it's good for the future of the league because we're finally going to get to see who could potentially break all of Brady's records and who could be the next GOAT. And that's what we're getting to. I'm not sold on any of the quarterbacks this year. I don't think Lamar Jackson will last. I was never impressed with him in college. Sam Darnold, I think, is only getting hyped because he played for the Jets in the same way Mark Sanchez was. And Josh Rosen and Josh Allen really haven't done anything of note. The only one who really stands out to me is Baker Mayfield because he's always won, he's always been doubted, and he somehow finds a way to win, and he's winning in Cleveland, and I just think that speaks volumes.
Can you imagine? I don't really want us to imagine because it's frightening. Could you imagine if, for instance, the Chiefs got wise to Andy Reid, decided to let him go, and hired Josh McDaniels to be the head coach with Patrick Mahomes as his quarterback? Like, what he could do with that kind of offensive weapon. That'd be frightening.
Not even McDaniels. Why would you not fire Andy Reid and hire Mike McCarthy?
Sorry, hire who? You cut out there for a second. I couldn't hear you.
Mike McCarthy.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I mean, that's an upgrade, certainly, but...
But
I don't know. McDaniels to me, it seems to be an offensive genius in so many ways. So, bring him in and just really highlight what is the centerpiece of your team going forward, which is going to be Patrick Mahomes, who has made some incredibly athletic plays, but I think could be so much better with someone who's more disciplined of a coach and someone who has a better mind than Andy Reid. So,
yeah, don't give him any ideas.
Point being, overall, that I think it's an interesting time to be an NFL fan. And I'm going to say something quasi-controversial here. Tom Brady is of course, my favorite NFL player. I have nothing but reverence for Tom Brady. But overall, I have reverence for greatness. And I look forward to these young players challenging the statistics of Tom Brady and Drew Brees and Peyton Manning or whatever, and seeing who does come out on top, who does throw more touchdown passes or has more yards in their career, etc. Because ultimately, I want to have reverence for people who do great things.
Did I just say that when I said now we get to see who gets to become the next greatest of all time?
You did. I just wanted to elaborate on it a bit.
You just wanted to seem like the good guy and paint me as the bad guy.
Typically.
No, I just hope we get the next GOAT. That's my big thing. Like, my big thing to tie this back to the Patriots and sort of round out this segment is, my big thing is, who's going to be our next quarterback? That's my big thing. That's the one thing I worry about, because it keeps me up at night. I have anxiety about, what if we don't get a quarterback and we're just one of these franchises that struggles without a quarterback for 10 to 15 years?
That is a scary thought. I don't, it is yet to be seen that if Belichick is like the quarterback whisperer who could pick out, the sixth round pick any given year and turn them into something incredible, or if that was a fluke or a convergence or a false dichotomy, bro, or whatever it is. But I hope he sticks around after Tom Brady decides to retire to shepherd the team into a new era, but we will see.
Okay, and I'm going to make a bold prediction here, okay?
No.
This is who I would like to see on the Patriots, because I think he's going to be something special in the pros, because I see a Tom Brady-like mentality and story in this guy.
Hmm.
Clemson University's backup quarterback, Chase Bryce. I love the kid. I like watching him more than Trevor Lawrence. I think he looks like a better football player than Trevor Lawrence. But just like with the history of time and just like with Brady, Trevor Lawrence is the young guy who's got all the physical intangibles, which you can win in college with that. but you need to develop the mental game, the psychological game to win in the pros. And when I see the way Chase Bryce carries himself, I see the way he reads the game, I see his throwing mechanics, I think Chase Bryce is going to be something special in the NFL if somebody is willing to take a chance on him the way Belichick took a chance on Brady. And in my deepest fantasies, I'd love to see Hunter Renfro and Chase Bryce on the Patriots because I think they're both Patriots-esque players.
You mean small and white?
Hey, you know what? No, it's just they play with the smartness and they play with the, not the chip on their shoulder, but just the idea that they have to earn it every day.
Yeah. So very quickly, this is not typically a thing we do, but because we don't do a lot of prognosticating, but do you have any thoughts about who will be in the Super Bowl this year? Slash, who you would like to see in the Super Bowl this year, which is obviously the Patriots and blah, 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 blah. But those could be two different answers.
Brady and Breeze play in the Super Bowl and round out this era. I think that would be phenomenal. And I think that has a dream. That has a highly statistical chance of happening.
Yes. Certainly higher than many other matchups. No team has a great statistical chance of making the Super Bowl, to be clear, but yeah.
Yeah, so out of the AFC, I'd either like to see the Patriots or the Texans. I can cheer for Brady or Watson, and I can be happy with doing that. Hopefully, if we lose, it's not to the Texans, but we'll see what happens. I think likely, though, it's either going to be Chiefs, Patriots, or Texans out of the AFC. Probably either Chiefs or Patriots, I would think. I think there's a high chance the Chiefs lose in the divisional round, which means I think the Patriots are probably going to, depending on what happens in the Steelers game today, I think they're probably going to host the AFC Championship game if the Chiefs lose. Mm-hmm. So it could very well be the Patriots again. I think the Saints are going to win the Super Bowl. I've been saying that for a few weeks now. They had that one sort of blip, but they've been winning when it matters, and this feels like another one of Breeze's seasons where we talk about how Philip Rivers is playing out of his mind, Drew Breeze is playing out of his mind, but we could also potentially see a really good narrative, and sometimes reality is stranger than fiction. If Jared Goff and the Rams beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl the way that the Patriots beat the Rams to start this era, now Goff beats the Patriots to start the new era of the younger quarterbacks, that could happen too. So there are a number of ways it could go.
And that would be the ultimate Brady retirement narrative, right?
You think he would retire?
I think the media would push him to retire. I don't know if he would. I'm saying that would be it's a closing out the way it began, but sort of inverse, whatever.
Right. And if you remember, they tried to do that with Russell Wilson and the Seahawks, because after the Seahawks really beat Peyton Manning, they were like, oh, you know, Russell Wilson's going to beat the two great quarterbacks from the last era, and he's going to ascend and become the next great quarterback. But as we know, that never materialized because Pete Carroll is terrible.
Yeah. He is, man, if you talk about someone with pure talent who I think is being underused because of bad coaching, my God, Russell Wilson
right
has an accuracy on him that's unbelievable.
Question about consistency, and that's why I think ultimately it'll probably be the Saints who win, because McVay and Goff still have a lot to prove about consistency. I don't believe in Mahomes and Reed. I don't think they had that consistency. I don't think Philip Rivers has that consistency. Watson had that consistency in the pros, in college, and if he can prove he has it in the pros, he could win the whole thing this year. So it's a lot of if these young guys can prove they have the consistency. And remember, the playoffs requires that extra level of consistency. The ability, not only the consistency, the ability to not be rattled and to respond to the outlier events.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're not hoping for an all Los Angeles Super Bowl? Chargers, Rams?
No, but I am sort of hoping that the Chargers win that division and then host the AFC Championship game against the Patriots, because that would be hilarious if I go to watch the Red Sox beat the Dodgers for the World Series and watch the Patriots beat the Chargers in the AFC Championship game. And then next year or 2 years from now, I peace out and it's like, hey, we took over and then I left.
All right, let's put a bow on this thing.
Well, first off, what are you prognosticating?
I'm prognosticating that it's Saints and then either Patriots, Chiefs, but I'm assuming it'll be the Patriots. I'm hoping it'll be the Patriots at least. Saints, Patriots Super Bowl would be the only one I think of my lifetime that I would contemplate going to. Now, I just don't think I have enough disposable income to do that, even to get like a nosebleed seat.
Yeah.
But it would be something that I would actually legitimately have to think about, because it would be two of the best quarterbacks of all time, probably the last time they'd ever play each other, in what would be just an epic game. But I think the Rams, though, have a decent shot. McVay hasn't shown consistency yet, but he has shown some innovative coaching and some really good coaching and an ability to game plan that I think is really hyper impressive. So I'm not going to count them out, but I do think it will be Saints and then Chiefs or Patriots.
All right. As you said, let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
I learned that as much as we love Patreon, it might be an abusive relationship. So we're going to have to see where Patreon goes, but we're watching you, Patreon. Don't try to ban us. Please ban us. That'd be great for us. Thank you. Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned what the ideal version of burying the lead is. We're going to write a whole article about how this guy hates gays, and then we find out at the end that he is gay.
That's right. Self-hating gay, much like a self-hating Catholic. Well, we hope, in fact, you... Oh my good God, did I have a stroke during this last segment?
It's the teething. It got you.
It really did. We hope you learned something this trip with us. And if you did, you can tell us on all the social medias at The Midside. You can also go to themidside.com/store and pick up your Midside swag in time for Christmas, probably, but just barely if you order it today. False Dichotomy Bro shirt, logo, Hell Snydra, etc. While you're on the internet, go to iTunes and Google Play and give us a 5-star rating. That would help us move up the ladder of the podcast. Help us get banned. Hashtag help us get banned. Yes.
I feel like we're just ripping off South Park, who did the whole cancel South Park thing this season.
Oh, they did? I haven't watched this season, so.
Yeah, their whole point of their entire season was why are all these other people who are less offensive and more reasonable than us getting banned and canceled when we're just here doing absurd shit and no one cancels us? What do we have to do to get canceled?
Funny. I like it. Well, hashtag help us get banned, and we can be in good company with South Park. And then thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating the show. Patreon.com/TheMidside if you want to support us. You can tweet at Patreon if you want to help us get banned. That would help. And then if you can't do any of that, no problem. I think the one thing you all have, though, are friends. And 'tis the season of giving. Why not give them the greatest gift of all? No, not your friendship, our show. Tell them about our show to prove how great of a friend you are, in fact. And that will be the gift that keeps on giving, at least until we're banned. Until next time, much love for you.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm your host, Justin L. Malini, reminding you that when things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day. You're just going to do the Adam Carolla thing now every week. Z-z-z-up.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. When name. I was listening to it this week, I was like, I should totally rip that off at the end because I've done that 2 weeks in a row. So I ripped it off.